From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Mark Bittman is concerned about how much corporations control our food, and he's here to explain why. Mark Bittman's books include Food Matters and How to Cook Everything, which is also a handy application for your cell phone. He's been a journalist for over 40 years and on the food beat for over 20 years. He's been a senior writer and editor at Cook's Illustrated before he came to the Times. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
You've written about the role government plays in the obesity problem here in the United States. What are some examples of how government policies could be leading to obesity, or at least not preventing it?
You know, the funny thing is that this argument is about, as you say, government role. And when you say, we'd like to see government discouraging the consumption of food that's bad for you and encouraging the consumption of good, people are in an uproar. Some people are in an uproar that it's not the right role of government to be influencing what we eat, but of course it does all the time. So you have agricultural subsidies to commodity crops, which are basically turned into either junk food or industrially produced meat. And you have something that's not talked about a lot is that you have the fact that marketing food is tax deductible. So a corporation can spend, say, $200 million to market its product, and that can be written off against taxes. So
but that's all marketing.
A huge subsidy.
That's not just to food, though, is
okay,
it?
Okay, but that is a huge subsidy.
Right, right. So you think they should carve out an exception and not allow food marketers to
have
a tax advantage?
I think that we should be looking at the consequences, which we are, looking at the consequences of what you might call the typical or standard American diet and say, this costs all of us money, and it costs many of us our health.
Well, in fact, in many ways, states and cities are probably ahead of the federal government when it comes to this. In New York City, Mayor Bloomberg has been focusing on sugary drinks, a ban on big gulp soda drinks that's just been unpopular among many people. Do you think that's the kind of step government should be taking?
I support the notion of a soda tax, which New York and San Francisco and Philadelphia have all come very, very close to passing. And according to some friends of mine, it's just in San Francisco, Richmond, California, which is north of Berkeley, is about to pass a soda tax, or may be about to pass a soda tax. And I think that would – soda is price sensitive. If you put a big enough tax on it, consumption will go down, and I think the public health benefits would be measurable. I mean, this is not me talking. This is what people who study these things say, that the public health benefits would be measurable within, say, 3 to 5 years. And the income from those taxes would be measurable instantly. And, you know, cities are strapped for money.
Yeah.
So if you figure out that, hey, we slap a 2 cents an ounce tax on soda, we're going to enhance the city coffers by some number of millions of dollars every year, that's not going to be so unpopular after all.
As a way to thread the needle on this meat issue, scientists are probably at this very moment working on growing meat in laboratories. In fact, PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, offered $1 million to the first scientist who brings test tube meat to the market. Have you ever tried it?
No.
What do you think about that? Is that a way to get beyond meat?
Well, yeah, theoretically. But here's the question. What are the resources that it requires to get this done? Why can we not eat things that are other than, I mean, why do you have to invent fake meat when there are real plants out there already? You have to know more before you make a judgment call on that. How does it get done? What resources does it take? What's the product wind up looking like? It's too soon to say. I mean, it's fine to do the research, but there's probably better research that could be done with the same money.
And then there's how our food is grown. Walter wrote to us when he found out you were going to be on. The community-supported agriculture capital acquisition model turns corporate capitalism on its head. Instead of paying for your groceries well after you eat them, the CSA shareholder pays for his or her food well in advance. Walter writes, industrial agriculture produces 1 kilocalorie from 7 to 10 kilocalories of fossil fuel. Obviously, we need lots of small-scale farmers to take the place of industrial agriculture. But he adds the question, this is the question part of it, this will not happen without some kind of capital acquisition model for small-scale producers. I mean, how do they get the capital that they need to make the community-supported agriculture grow?
Well, no argument there. It's all true and correct. And when we talk about small-scale farmers, you know, I think many of us think of people with 2 or 4 or maybe 15 acres. I was at an organic farm in the Central Valley of California the other day of 75 acres, and to me that was incredibly big. But on the same day, I visited two, three, and 10,000 acre farms of not run in the same style. There is a huge question about how we get young people into farming and a huge question about how we get farms into the hands of people who really want to grow food. And I think the size farm that we need to be looking at for sustainability is probably, say, 100 to 500. I mean, it's an arbitrary number, but 100 to 500 acres, something that can actually be run by a number of people, maybe even by a family. How does that happen? I don't know. CSAs alone are certainly not going to do it.
Say what you will about industrial agriculture, it pumps out a lot of food. So could small-scale farming on along the lines that you just described produce enough food?
You know, but I was in the Central Valley. I went to the Central Valley because I wanted my mind to be blown, and it was blown within about 3 minutes of my arrival. When you see mountains, literally, of almonds, a man standing next to a mountain of almonds, when you see 30, 40, 50 truckloads of carrots harvested every single day from one. It is just incredible. So how does that happen? And, you know, the progress isn't obviously doesn't, things don't change overnight. I don't sit here and say, here's how it happens. And then 3 weeks from tomorrow, we're suddenly looking at a different form of agriculture. I think a couple of things have to happen gradually. One is we need to see more medium-sized farms, say the 1 to 500 acre size I was talking about. And another is we need to get back to a more regional model. You know, this is a very big country. France is the same size as Texas, and Germany and Great Britain are about the same size as California. Those are relatively small and manageable. We're trying to manage a national food system, the system in quotes, because it's not much of a system, in, you know what, the third or fourth biggest country in the world, and by the way, the most productive. So if we were to look at this country as a coalition of not 50 states but 5 or 6 regions, and this doesn't have to be politically, but it could be, but if we started to think, how can New England, for example, or the Northeast, how can the Southeast, how can the Northwest be more self-sufficient, I think you start to get a handle on how this can actually work.
Is industrial agriculture always a bad idea? That image of the mountains of almonds, I thought, that's fine with
it's
me.
It's great.
Grow all
it's
the
amazing.
Almonds there and send them up here.
I'm
okay with that.
Astonishing. It's astonishing.
So does it work in some regards
for
some
crops? I think it does. No, yeah. I think it does. And I think we're going to see, and I did see a little of this last week, I think we're going to see more and more sort of crossover agriculture. I don't know what you want to call it, but I met organic farmers who said, well, we're not certified organic anymore because we think that there are places where synthetic or whatever you want to call them, chemical fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, et cetera, are more targeted and therefore safer than the broad spectrum, if you will, organic versions of these things. And then I also met conventional farmers, guys who were farming tens of thousands of acres, who were using organic techniques, who were concerned about the quality of their soil and their water and so on. So I think you're going to start to see more and more of that.
Not a lot of time, but I'll ask you this big question anyway. I mean, it seems like your overarching argument is that the market economy is failing us when it comes to food.
Well, it is a big question because I could say we don't have a market economy. We're subsidizing the production of bad food. If we're going to subsidize something, let's at least subsidize the production of good food.
Fair enough. Mark Bittman, thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate it.
It's fun.
You can read him in the New York Times. His books include Food Matters and How to Cook Everything. Sweets are not just candy. They're also an important cultural signifier. Julia Harrison has been exploring the history of sweets in Washington history. Julia Harrison is an anthropologist, an artist, and a scholar of sweets. 4 years ago, she began the Sweet Travel blog, when she went on an 85-day sweets safari to Japan. She now has got some 300 entries that you can check out there. She's currently creating an online multimedia map of bakeries, desserts, and candy makers around Puget Sound. She's going to curate a 2013 exhibition for the Wing Luke Museum on Asian sweets in the Northwest. And Julia is one of Imani Washington's scholars. She's touring the state with a program called A World of Sweets in Washington, revealing what our sweets say about our shared history and our culture. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you. I'm so delighted to be here with you.
It's kind of hard to imagine today when everywhere you go, you're surrounded by sugar and sweets, but they used to be very hard to come by, and they had a certain significance in culture, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, sweet flavors are one of the things that is a liking for sweet flavors is sort of programmed into people, and part of that was that sweet flavors in our early evolutionary days indicated that a food was safe to eat and a good source of energy, but those sweet flavors were so scarce that for most of human history, gathering in them enough of them to eat was actually a net loss in calories. So going after something like fruit or honey was a pretty big drain on your resources. So the big change came with the introduction of sugarcane, which spread from Papua New Guinea around the world and the kind of rolling waves of technology.
And a little bit closer to home, you found that it was sugar that brought many Latin Americans to the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, that's true. One of the first waves of migration was, first of all, to the Rockies, but it was for the harvesting of sugar beet. But during World War II, there was a bumper crop of sugar beets, and there was a labor shortage, so there weren't enough local laborers to harvest them. And there was a special arrangement between the Mexican government and the U.S. government to bring in guest workers to harvest those. And a lot of people ended up staying and moving towards this part of the country and being sort of experts in that sugar beet harvesting field.
You have documented that we have sweets from more than 40 countries and cultures here in the Puget Sound area. What are some of the more unusual ones that you might not think of?
Sure. Well, one of the great examples of a place where I got to sample a bunch of things at one time was the recent Viking Days celebration up at the Nordic Heritage Museum. And one of the cakes that I was really delighted to get to try was a special Icelandic torte that is, I can't pronounce the name properly, so I'm not even going to try on that one, but it's layer upon layer of a cardamom-flavored shortbread, and they would slice it up and layer it with a spiced prune jam, and then I think some of the recipes call for it to be weighted, but in any case, you leave it for several days, so the whole thing kind of compresses and all the flavors infuse together, and then you would slice off very thin pieces.
So one of the really interesting things that you're doing is you're studying how bakeries and sweet foods kind of connect us all, and one of the things that you've uncovered is that they were Japanese confectioners here way back in the 1920s, but not a Chinese bakery until 1979. Now, both ethnic groups were here. What's that say about what was going on?
There was actually a Japanese bakery here as early as 1900. It was called Sagamiya, and it was downtown on 5th and Jackson. And they had a thriving business and also several competitors up through the 1920s. Then the Chinese thing is completely different. And I think that has to do with Chinese migrants. When they came here, they were laborers and they were working in kind of horrible, heavy industry situations. They were mostly male and they did pretty well for themselves. And so very early on, people started to get a little bit nervous. And in the 1880s, they passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. And what that did was say that no new Chinese laborers were allowed into the country. And then when the Japanese were kind of in a similar situation, the difference was that they were allowed to bring their families over. So if they were already established here, that they could save their money, buy land, and bring their families. And so they were able to really continue a lot of their traditions in a way that the Chinese migrants weren't able to. So by the 19 teens, in this area, there were 26 Chinese men for every single Chinese woman. So that gives you an idea of what a skewed society it was. And so things that were a part of family life and celebrations, really, there just wasn't enough of a critical mass to support a commercial baker. And then obviously the tables kind of turned in World War II. And when the Japanese were incarcerated in the internment camps, about a year and a half later, the Chinese Exclusion Act was reversed. And so Chinese families began to have more of a base here in this area.
Now, some of these ethnic sweets like mochi has kind of broken out of its individual cultural group that it came from. But are there still a lot of sweets that kind of reside with Japanese Americans or with Scandinavians that don't really get out there very far?
I would say that there are some things that people are still a little squeamish about if they're not part of the tradition that they grew up with. One of my absolute favorite sweets ingredients that I'm from the South originally. We have a plant there that's called kudzu that most people are not particularly fond of. And I, one of my favorite types of Japanese sweets is actually made with kudzu. They go out and harvest it in the winters. It's indigenous to the country, so they've kind of had more time to figure out ways of using it. And they go out and harvest it in the winter, reduce it to a powdered starch, and then in the summer, they use it to make these clear, glassy, gelatinous noodles that you eat in iced molasses syrup. So when, you know, when it's 1,000 degrees and 100% humidity, that is one of the most refreshing things that you can eat. But I know that even in the Deep South, that idea, refreshing as it is in the summer, might seem a little bit anathema to people.
Julia Harrison, thank you so much for telling us about sweets.
Thank you so much for having me.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.